This podcast is part of a series that deals with the values of our churches. In this edition, we look at the value of unified relationships. When I think about unified relationships, without doubt, it seems like if there is one area that we have been tested in as churches, this has been it. How many times, both in your own heart and in your own mind and as a group, have you been faced with the idea and the issue of disunity? You know, this person frustrates you. You don't like the way that this person does that. Or as a group, sometimes even your churches have come to active disagreement. And to be totally honest, there have been times where I've secretly wondered in the back of my mind, could this actually be the division which leads to their end? Amazingly, though, it never has. And what I think is even more amazing is that it oftentimes seems that what the enemy intended for evil, the Lord redeems and makes for our good. As you go through these waters and walk the way of the cross, it so often seems that you as people and you as churches emerge stronger. Something in the midst of it is redeemed, and you become even more wonderful than what you were before you went through that point of disunity. Well, today as we look at the unified relationships, I want us to find our instruction from the scriptures themselves. And actually, what I want us to do is have a good old-fashioned Bible study. We're going to walk very briefly through the book of Galatians, and as we do, what we're going to discover there is a church that was in the very early stages of war. The war was a serious war, but it was just beginning to emerge. And Paul then writes to them, first of all, to deal with the issue, but then maybe even more significantly, to deal with the disunity that was stirring up in their midst. So what I want us to do is just grab a Bible. If you need to shut me off, go for it. And then flip to the letter of Galatians, and we'll walk through it together. Okay, let's dig in. In the first two chapters, what we see here is Paul speaking about his own conversion and how he had been entrusted with apostolic authority to preach the gospel to the Gentiles while leaving the work with the Jews to Peter. In some ways, the opening chapters are quite biographical. But amidst his explanation, which I think, incidentally, he's using as a statement on even why he has the authority to write them, an authority which has obviously been questioned within the church. Amidst his explanation about his authority, when we get to chapter 2, verse 3, we begin to get our first little hint at the main concern of the letter. See, when we get there, and you can look there yourself, in this section, Paul makes reference to a trip that he made to Jerusalem, where some Jews, it seemed, tried to convince Titus, who was a Greek, that in order to be a follower of Christ, he needed also to accept circumcision, and that he also needed to begin to follow the old Jewish law, the Torah. And this was something for which reasons we'll soon discover Paul and Titus wanted absolutely nothing to do with. Let me read this little section. Paul says in chapter 2, verse 1, 14 years later, I went up again to Jerusalem, this time with Barnabas, and I took Titus along also. I went in response to a revelation and set before them the gospel that I preach among the Gentiles, but I did this privately to those who seemed to be leaders for fear that I was running or had run my race in vain. Yet not even Titus, who was with me, was compelled to be circumcised, even though he was a Greek. This matter arose because some false brothers who had infiltrated our ranks to spy on the freedom we have in Christ Jesus and to make us slaves. We did not give in to them for a moment so that the truth of the gospel might remain in you. Okay, so again, we have this scenario. It seems like people are trying to compel Titus to be circumcised, and they didn't give in to it for a moment. Now, were this to stand on its own, we'd think to ourselves, well, that's an interesting little thing, but you know, we wouldn't make too much about that little reference that Paul makes in this letter, but it doesn't stand on its own. Because what Paul then goes on to describe next is another scenario. And this time it's with Peter, but there are these similar themes that emerge. This is toward the end of chapter 2. As he finishes off his biography, he turns to this disagreement that he had had with Peter when he came to visit Paul in Antioch. And as Paul recounts the story, he articulates that Peter, a Jew, used to feel quite comfortable eating with Gentile believers. However, after an encounter with a group of people, perhaps the same group of people that Titus had encountered, after an encounter with a group of people who were preaching the need to obey the Torah and for the Gentiles to continue to be circumcised, that they needed Christ plus the Torah, Peter then, it seems like, began to draw back and separate himself from the Gentile believers who were choosing not to follow Torah while they followed Christ. And what was going on as well, it seems, is that Peter was also apparently trying to enforce or to encourage people to follow these Jewish practices, even though Paul says Peter himself wasn't even following them any longer. Okay, so let's see if I can make sense of this for us. In his biography, we have these two stories which recount something similar. Namely, the idea that some Jews were trying to infiltrate these churches and influence others to the idea that they needed to practice Jewish practices as well as following Christ. And at least in one story, we see the idea was causing some Jews, namely Peter, to break fellowship with Gentiles, to be disunified with them, those that were unwilling to follow the Jewish customs. And horror of horror to Paul, you know, as I say, Peter himself was the one that was opening up this disunity. Okay, so with these two chapters, of autobiographical chapters out of the way, by the time we now turn into chapter 3, it seems that all of those other little stories set the stage for Paul's concern with the Gentiles in Galatia. And now he turns his attention to the church itself. And so in verse 1, he lets loose with this harshest criticism that you're ever going to see in any of Paul's letters. He starts off this. He says, "You foolish Galatians, who has bewitched you?" And in this line, we get that some people have come in, just as they did with Peter and just as they did with Titus, to confuse them. Well, what have they been confused with? As we go on, we'll see they've been confused with the same thing that Peter was confused with and the same thing that they tried to confuse Titus with. It seems that some people had come into the Galatian church and tried to convince them that Jesus himself and the gift of the Spirit was not enough for them, but that they also needed these laws, Torah observance, circumcision as well, that they needed all of these things really to be righteous and to be declared holy before God. Now, Paul sheds a little bit of light on these people infiltrating his camp as he goes along. So one example that he sheds is chapter 4, verses 15 to 17. Look at what it says there. "What has happened to all your joy? I can testify that if you could have done so, you would have torn out your eyes and given them to me. Have I now become your enemy by telling you the truth? Those people are zealous to win you over." See, he's citing there are people that are coming, but for no good. "What they want is to alienate you from us." There's the disunity thing. They're trying to separate these people from Paul and from others that say, no, you don't need to practice the Jewish religion. Okay, and the Jewish Torah. Again, chapter 5, verse 7, we see more examples of these people coming in. "You were running a good race. Who cut in on you and kept you from obeying the truth?" Right, so some, again, he's citing, some have come in. Chapter 6, verse 12. "Those who want to make a good impression outwardly," in other words, by practicing all of these laws, "are trying to compel you to be circumcised. The only reason they do this is to avoid being persecuted for the cross of Christ." So again, just examples of how people are infiltrating the ranks, just as they did with, or attempted to with Titus, and just as it seems that they accomplished even with Peter himself, the great Peter. So question is why was this idea of following the law so crazy for Paul? Well, it was so because for Paul, Jesus Christ and the power of the Spirit totally removed the requirements of the law. Because what the law sought to do, namely enable people to be righteous, Jesus accomplished completely. So for Paul, Jesus and not the law was the one that enabled them to overcome their sinful hearts and to live as a people who bear new fruits of righteousness, the fruit of the Spirit. And therefore, to go back to the law was like a slap in the face to the totally complete work of Jesus. Like Paul was saying, you don't need the law. Absolutely you don't need the law, not any part of it, because you have everything you need for righteousness and for godliness in Christ, and he alone has made you holy. And as he says in some of the stronger parts of the letter, if you go back to the law, then you need to try and complete it entirely your righteousness through the law. Because in that act, you are saying somehow to Christ that he and his work on the cross was not enough for you. It was so significant to Paul, the issue, that that the people of Galatia and all of his churches understood that Christ and Christ alone was all they needed for their righteousness. They did not need circumcision any longer. They did not need the law. The law failed in making them holy, but Jesus Christ did it completely. Okay, but here now is where the rubber really hits the road in this church. Because as we mine into the argument, we discover that not only is there a problem with their beliefs, but it's also with their practices. It seems that the commotion with this wrong thinking has also led to infighting, and infighting of the worst kind. It seems that some were being conceited in their newfound holiness, feeling that their approach to the gospel was a result and was right, and as a result, infighting was ensuing that was leading to disunity and a separation of the saints from each other. Listen to a couple of examples that Paul hints at. First, in chapter 4, verse 17 again. These people are zealous to win you over, but for no good. What they want is to alienate you from us, even as Peter was separated from the Gentiles at the table. Chapter 5, verse 15, he says, if you keep on biting and devouring each other, watch out, or you will be destroyed by each other. Stop, you're fighting over this. You're going to destroy each other. In chapter 5, verse 25, we catch a little bit of the nature that of the infighting that involves some being conceited with their newfound righteousness. It says, since we live by the Spirit, let us keep in step with the Spirit. Let us not become conceited, provoking and envying each other. And on it goes throughout their letter. There are all these examples of the nature of the fighting. So it appears then that a double-sided problem is really at work in the church. We've got a false thinking about the fullness of Christ that is broken in. And this then was leading to disruption of the church, as some were being conceited in their position. And it was the same thing that happened, exactly the same thing that happened with Peter as he began to separate himself from the Gentiles that were not willing to follow the Torah. And all of this disunity was pulling Paul back into great upheaval for the church. So we need to see, though, that throughout Paul's letters, he displays continually these two primary concerns that we see highlighted here in Galatians. Both of which, again, as I just say, we see here. Paul is deeply concerned about the integrity of the Jesus story. That's the one thing. He's deeply concerned that people fully understand that Christ himself is supreme and sufficient for all they need, that they do not need to add anything to him in order to attain righteousness, that as we come to him, we are made righteous, and as we follow him by the Spirit, he will complete the work that he began in us, again, by the Spirit. Paul says this in chapter 3, verse 3, one of my favorite verses in the entire scriptures. He says, are you so foolish? After beginning with the Spirit, are you now trying to attain your goal, in other words, righteousness, by human effort, works of the law? Have you suffered so much for nothing, if it really was for nothing? Does God give you a Spirit and work miracles among you because you observe the law or because you believed what you heard, the story of the gospel? So that's the first thing that Paul's concerned about. The second thing that he's always concerned about in his letters, though, is directly linked to this, and that is the unity of the saints. The idea that Peter would stop eating with the Gentiles made his stomach turn. The idea that Titus might be looked down upon because he was not circumcised was anathema. And the idea that the church in Galatia was at odds with each other, boasting over each other in pride, he says in Galatia, makes him feel like he's a woman in childbirth. And all you women that have experienced childbirth think to yourself, well, Paul, you have no idea what you're talking about. But that's what he says anyways. I feel like I'm in labor over you. I'm so hurt over your disunity. The question is, though, why was the unity of their relationship so important? And we can understand why he would fight for the truth of the gospel story. All of us, I'm sure, get that. But why was it the other side of the coin? Well, it was so, according to Paul, because the failure of their unity was directly attached to the power of the Jesus story. You see, for Paul, at its very core, the power of the gospel was wrapped up in the power of this thing called reconciliation. The gospel of Jesus ensured that the two could now become one. First, humans could now become one with God, reconciled to him through the power of the blood and the gift of the Spirit. But secondly, the power of the gospel also meant that a divided and warring humanity, a warring that began way back in the Garden of Eden, where sin first entered the picture, that this warring humanity could now be reconciled to each other through the power of the Spirit, which was at work in its great wonder of love. And so for Paul, when unity failed in some way, the gospel failed. Now, of course, not really, but the outworking of the gospel failed. It's why Paul's letters are filled with these amazing statements. In Christ, there is no longer Jew nor Greek, male nor female, slave nor free, but all are one in one. Why? Because the gospel of Jesus, if it had any power, was a gospel of reconciliation. And when the reconciliation broke down, oh, no, it could not be. It was really, all of this was the fulfillment of Jesus' prayer in John 17, where he prayed for the believers and said, may they be one so the world may see and know. It was all about the power of the gospel to complete its work of reconciliation in human relationships. What I love about it all, though, is that to this church, obviously divided and about to devour itself, Paul's answer in the end remains the same. It's the same answer he always gives to every church. And the answer is this: you need to allow the Spirit who began you to complete you. You need to live by the Spirit, surrender to Him and not to your flesh. You don't live by the law, you live by the Spirit. Take up the cross in the power of the Spirit and submit to the Christ life. And when you do this, says Paul in Galatians, you will produce fruit that is in keeping with the gospel. Which is exactly his point when he comes to this section in Galatia, which we call the fruit of the Spirit. We often read these things like they're nice, internal lists of qualities that we should have. Oh, I want to be loving, and I would like to be peaceful, or whatever it is. But when we take them in their proper context, Paul is writing to a church at war, and he's saying, live by the Spirit, keep in step by the Spirit, and then you will produce this kind of fruit in your community. You will be at love with one another. You will be at peace with one another. You will have kindness with one another. You will have joy with one another. See, it's all of these community fruit. That's what the fruit is. It's community fruit. And the question is, what does this have to do with you? Well, one of our values is this thing called unified relationships. Why did God speak to us about this? He did so, I believe, because he knew that the testimony of the gospel to our world around us was built upon it. Jesus came to make the two one. He came to bring peace between God and people, and between people and the rest of creation. He came to make the two one, and the world is waiting to see if it's true. What a grievance when it fails. So much is at stake. We catch a glimpse of it when we read Paul's letters. So much of it is at stake. So all this to say to you as people, fight for unity. Fight for it. Fight for reconciliation. Fight to be together. Fight to think well in your heart and in your mind about the other people in the church. Give grace. Give love. How? By the Spirit. Live by the Spirit, says Paul, and you will no longer gratify the desires of your sinful nature. Lay down your lives and allow the Spirit to fill you with His presence. And then you will produce fruit in keeping with the gospel, fruit that is not backbiting and devouring, slandering, gossiping, anger-filled, but fruit that is good and fruit that stirs up unity. Fight for unity.